Welcome to Abide in Liberty, a podcast empowering patriots everywhere to re-enthrone faith, family, and freedom as the bedrock pillars of liberty in education, our communities, and our nation.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to this week's Abide in Liberty episode. We're going to be doing today part six of our series on the miracles of the American Revolution. We've done five parts to this so far. It kind of started before No Screen November, and we did the fifth one just last week. So go back and listen to those if you haven't yet. It's going to make this episode so much more meaningful if you come into it with that background. So we left off last week with the Continental Army just kind of crawling out and thawing out at Valley Forge. They just passed this terrible winter. They'd gotten some help in the form of a German general who kind of toward the tail end of that winter whipped them into shape and got them into fighting form for the upcoming spring campaign. And from there, the Americans are better prepared. They're better trained than they've ever been before. You've got the British, who had, you know, kind of indulged themselves all winter long and grown soft, while the American army had become leaned and hardened and really ready to tackle anything. I mean, they had survived the horrors of Valley Forge. Now, from this point on, because the Americans are a little bit better prepared and are more skilled in battle, they've been drilled, they've become not exactly equal necessarily to the experience and skill of the British Army, but they've become much closer than they've ever been before. The miracles of the American Revolution at this point become a little bit less conspicuous. They're maybe a little bit easier for secular historians to explain away through other means or to just gloss over altogether. I'm reminded there's an interesting object lesson or an interesting experiment, if you will, that's outlined in the Book of Mormon, where you've got two groups of people who are each of them stuck in a sticky situation and they get heavenly help to escape it. These are actually two groups that were contemporaries. They were around at the same time and they were captured by the same group of Lamanites. I'm talking about Alma, the elder, who escaped with his followers from the oppressive regime of wicked King Noah and began to set up their own society. And then the folks who they left behind eventually repented themselves. Noah was killed and his son Limhi became king in his place. But at this time, the Lamanites subjugated them and had them basically working as the Lamanites' slaves. So they found themselves in this oppressive situation. But in the case of Limhi, after some time and some severe hardship under the oppressive Lamanite rule, one of the king's advisors, a man named Gideon, recommended to him that they take some of the wine that the Nephites had become very good at producing. In fact, back during the reign of King Noah, it talks about how this entire people had become wine bibbers. This was kind of how they passed their time, lots of drinking. Now, under Limhi's rule, they weren't drunks like they were under King Noah's rule, but they still had the resources. They still had, you know, the ability to make this wine, even though they were now under Lamanite rule. So what they did was they prepared wine for the Lamanites. They went and offered it to the guards of the Lamanites who were responsible for keeping them hemmed in, and the guards greedily took it, fell into a drunken stupor, fell asleep, and Limhi and his people were able to escape, and they make their way back to the main Lamanite body in Zarahemla. When the Lamanites wake up and discover their captives gone, they take off after them, weren't able to find them, but stumbled upon Alma's group and the society that they and the city that they had begun building. Now, Alma, though, and his people didn't have the benefit of this well-established wine-producing industry. They were just kind of building a city from scratch. So although they were happy, they were industrious, they were making great progress in building their society and their city, they didn't have quite the number of resources that the that Limhi's people had. So in that case, the same thing happened. The Lamanites who were set to guard them fell asleep. But this time it wasn't because of the wine of Alma and his people that they'd offered to them. God caused this sleep to fall on the Lamanites so that Alma and his people could escape. They too left and joined the main body of the Nephites in Zarahemla and were reunited with, you know, Limhi and his group. And they were both, it was a joyous time where they came back together and found that they were both still strong and faithful and that they were able to overcome the differences that had caused them to separate in the first place. Now, both of these, it might be easy to look at the case of Limhi and say, well, they had wine. God didn't need to help them, so he didn't. But he did help Alma. I would contend that God was the author of both of these miracles, but in the case of Limhi, he inspired them to use the resources that they had in a way that allowed them to escape, whereas Alma and his people had no such resources, so he stepped in and orchestrated this miracle as well. But in the case of Alma, this miracle was a little bit more in your face. It's a little bit more obvious to see God's hand. Either way, God was the author of both of these incredible escapes from captivity. For the next years of the American Revolution, I think we're kind of in this situation, kind of like Limhi, where at this point, the army had developed to the point, the American army had developed to the point that God's miracles weren't as obvious. God was inspiring them to make use of the resources and the skills that they had obtained in ways that were miraculous, but we don't see quite as much of the weather in, you know, stepping in and saving the day like we've talked about in prior weeks. You know, when we look at them, the Americans standing bravely against the most well-trained fighting force in the world, it's easier to explain away that no, God wasn't inspiring them. They were just better prepared this time. Or when George Washington or one of the other leaders comes upon this brilliant strategy and implements it to great success, it's easier to look at that and just say, hey, this guy's learning how to become a better leader. They're you know, they had a stroke of genius. They had some kind of inspiration. Something clicked in their heads. Doesn't necessarily mean that it was God. In my view, though, obviously God was behind inspiring the hearts of the American soldiers to fight on and inspiring their leaders with ideas for holding out and kind of wearing out the British over the course of the next few years. And I think this is true in general. As we develop skill and competence, God may not need to interfere in ways that are as obvious. But that doesn't mean that he's behind us. In our country right now, we're incredibly blessed, incredibly prosperous. We've got all these modern conveniences, and it's easy to see that, no, God's not really involved. It's maybe harder to see his hand than say for Moses when they were trapped against the Red Sea and God parted the Red Sea. But just because it's not as obvious doesn't mean he's not there and doesn't mean that his interposition on our behalf isn't just as miraculous and meaningful. You know, I've kind of noticed this recently with the school that my wife and I help run. When we first started this 7 years ago, we prayed about every single little decision, and it seemed like every single decision, no matter how small, we got very clear answers to those prayers. Now, 7 years later, it seems like we still get a lot of very crystal clear answers to our prayers, but more and more it seems that we don't always get those crystal clear answers. It's almost as if God, in some of these instances, is saying, hey, you've got this one. You can figure this one out. Now, that's not a reason for us to become proud or to think that we've got things figured out. The fact that, you know, after 7 years, we're just now starting to get to the point where every decision that we come to on our own isn't a bad one that God needs to step in and correct is in itself a miracle. That the God of the universe and all that he has to pay attention to has been patient enough to provide us with 7 years of coaching, and that he's finally getting to the point where he's gotten through our thick, imperfect skulls enough that he can trust us to come to the right decision on our own on minor issues, and that he's been patient with us without removing the stewardship from us because of our imperfections. That's a miracle of astronomical proportions, in my view, that he can take someone as imperfect as me and pound even a modicum of sense into me over the course of 7 years is a miracle worthy of my undying praise for the rest of my life. I've got a long way to go yet, but maybe I'm starting to see that with an eternity of time and God's infinite patience, I can get there. And I think maybe this might be kind of where the American, the Continental Army is kind of at this point. He's able to work miracles maybe a little more in the background or trust George Washington's decisions a little bit more because he's learned something along the way. But that doesn't make the ensuing years any less miraculous. Now, typically in history, when people gain a little competence, when they become experienced, when things become a little easier, this is where things tend to fall apart. Pride enters, dependence on God wanes, and we tend to get into serious trouble. And this is a major temptation. We see this repeated over and over again among the children of Israel in the Bible and among the children of Lehi in the Book of Mormon. In our personal lives, this is why it is vital that we attend church regularly, that we are reading our scriptures every day, and we're fostering and building our relationships with our families, because this is where we come face to face with our own imperfections. We're reminded by others who see things in ourselves that we can't, what we need to do to keep on moving. We face our own imperfection in these situations, and those are important reminders to keep us humble and to keep us moving in the right direction and to keep us growing. Now, spirituality was equally important for the Continental Army, and a couple things kept them from slipping into this cycle of pride. Number one, all of the hardships did not disappear. We still have the issue with an inept National Congress that couldn't raise enough funds. So a couple years after Valley Forge, we have another terrible winter where the soldiers are underfed, underclothed, and in just a miserable state. The Americans are not, by their continuous encounters with the British, are not ever able to completely forget the fact that the British are better equipped, better trained than them, even though the Americans have come a very long way in their own development. And number two, they had a leader in George Washington who refused to take credit for the successes that they had had. He continued to maintain a complete reliance on God, and he demanded the same of his soldiers, his leaders, and the army as a whole. Now, a lesser man, having lasted this long and pulled off this many miracles against the most powerful fighting force the world had ever seen, would have easily become puffed up, egotistical, and prideful. Eventually, he came to be called and known as the essential man. And that is true because very few would have been able to resist the alluring temptation of self-inflation in these circumstances. Now, this isn't to say that there were no miracles in the ensuing years in the American Revolution. In the South, during the Southern campaign against General Cornwallis, the American army kind of got into trouble toward the end of the war, and they were in full retreat. The British were chasing them, and the British had all the advantage. It was pretty well accepted at this point that if the British caught them, the Southern army was over. But three times in succession, the Americans crossed a river only to have a large storm sweep through and flood the river and slow the British down behind them and slow the crossing of the British down. The British commander of all the forces, Henry Clinton, wrote this: "Here the Royal Army was again stopped by a sudden rise of waters, which had only just fallen almost miraculously to let the enemy over, who could not else have eluded Lord Cornwallis's grasp. So close was he upon their rear. Even the British couldn't help but notice God's hand in these events, even if they stopped short of fully admitting that God was on the American side." For all these reasons, we're going to skip to the end of the war. God's working his miracles in the background. We still have some miraculous weather events that keep the American cause alive and well. And I think in large part under that sort of a situation, the Americans were kind of wearing the British down. They were outlasting them, but no, there was really no major ground won or lost, no decisive victories to put an end to the war. And it looked like this thing was reaching a stalemate. So in order to strike the finishing blow on the American Revolution, the colonists were still too weak to bring that about on their own. And so God once again stepped in very obvious, very visible, and very miraculous ways to bring about the end of the war in Yorktown in 1981. So Cornwallis, after chasing the American army and being stopped by these flooding rivers, ultimately decided, look, it's time to regroup with the main body of the British Army in New York. So he marched to Yorktown, which was a town right on the ocean in Virginia. And the plan was he was just going to kind of hunker down there, fortify the city, and wait for the British Navy from New York to sail down the Atlantic coast and pick him and his army up from Yorktown and take them back so they'd all be in one large body. Well, the problem with that was he did get to Yorktown and he did hunker down and prepare some redoubts, some fortifications in case the Americans decided to try and attack while they're waiting for the Navy to come pick them up. But while the Navy was en route from New York down to Yorktown, they ran into the French fleet, which had just barely arrived from across the Atlantic Ocean. There was a battle that happened here. The French beat them and the British were sent back to New York. Now, this might not sound all that miraculous in and of itself. Maybe lucky timing. I mean, that in and of itself to me is miracle enough. But I want to put this in perspective for you. The historian Thomas Fleming noted that between the years 1588 and 1941, so 360 years about, the British ruled the waves. They won every encounter and they dominated every force that they fought on the high seas during that 350-year period of time with one exception. And that was this encounter with the French as they were going down to try and rescue Cornwallis at Yorktown. That was no accident. With the British Navy now back in New York, Cornwallis was stuck. So he further fortified Yorktown. The Americans began building trenches that kind of zigzagged their way up to the British fortifications. And as they were entrenched, you know, they were shelling Yorktown. The Americans were, they were in these trenches to protect themselves from the British. And they're digging these trenches closer and closer as the siege progressed through the ensuing days. About this time, this is when we get the courageous story of Alexander Hamilton leading a force of men to take Redoubt Number 10. This is one of the main British fortifications around Yorktown that was keeping the British safe while they were getting very anxious in awaiting their rescue. At this point, it wasn't just, hey, we're going to hang out here and then we'll get out of here quickly, but it was becoming desperate. They're starting to get nervous. The British fleet didn't arrive because they'd been repulsed by the French. So in a pretty daring attempt, the French led a force to go take Redoubt Number 9, and Alexander Hamilton led the second force to take Redoubt Number 10. They unloaded their weapons, fixed bayonets, raced across the open ground, stormed this fortification, and through a couple of minutes of brutal hand-to-hand combat, were able to throw the British off. The French didn't have quite so easy of a time. It took them a little longer. They experienced a lot of other casualties, but ultimately, they take these fortifications, which forced the British to withdraw further into Yorktown. About this time, Cornwallis is freaking out. He has no idea what to do. He gets word, though, that the British are going to try to get down again. So the British prepare they load up all of their army onto these ships. They're going to take these ships down, fight their way down through the French into Yorktown, unload their army, get Cornwallis out of there, and save the British army from defeat. Well, on the day that they were supposed to leave New York, this is what happened, according to Thomas Fleming. On October 13th, and this was in 1981, the fleet was supposed to set sail when a tremendous thunderstorm swept over New York Harbor, Terrific gusts of wind snapped the anchor cable on one of the ships of the line, smashing her into another ship and damaging both of them. The British could not leave until the damage was repaired. So at this point, Cornwallis knows there's no help coming. He's on his own. So he, in a desperate attempt to get away, tries to cross the York River so he can get his army across and then march their way up to New York to join the main body of the British. So he may have been thinking he's going to try what George Washington succeeded in doing in escaping New York and sneaking his army across and getting away to safety. Well, the difference between those two situations is that God and the weather were on Washington's side then. God was not on Cornwallis's side. Cornwallis later wrote that when they embarked, when they started crossing the York River, the weather was calm, but then the weather changed suddenly to a most violent storm of wind and rain. With no help, no retreat, Cornwallis was forced to surrender. Now, as it happens in most wars, it was not immediately obvious at the time that this was the final battle, but the final major battle it was. There are a few minor skirmishes after that that amounted to relatively little, but in short order, the British left New York and a peace treaty with the British was eventually signed in Paris in 1783. Now, Washington, in writing about the Battle of Yorktown, said, "I take particular pleasure in acknowledging that the interposing hand of heaven in various instances of our preparations for this operation has been most conspicuous and remarkable." And again, this is another one of those fantastic examples of how obvious God's hand was in bringing about this incredible victory that never should have happened. Not only that, and I forgot to mention this earlier, but before deciding to attack Yorktown, George Washington, he actually wasn't really interested in Cornwallis at Yorktown. When he looked at the situation, he saw them on the ocean, easy evacuation for the Navy to come down. I mean, he saw all of that. That'd be really easy for that Navy to come down, scoop them up, and that there's very relatively little logical chance of there being any kind of decisive, victorious outcome in this battle. He was laser focused on, we've got to get New York back. That's the strategic point. And for some reason, he changed his mind and gambled on this situation in Yorktown. And God stepped in, pulled some major strings, and ended the American Revolution in favor of the American colonists. I want to read something from the Washington Hypothesis that does a good job, I feel like, of summarizing just how unlikely it was that the Americans won this war. It says, "Shortly after the war, Charles Thompson, Secretary of the Continental Congress, proposed to Washington that the two of them collaborate on writing their memoirs of the entire war experience. After all, Thompson had been present during all the congressional actions, while Washington could account for the battles. Between the two of them, they could tell the entire story. However, upon outlining the project, they realized how the results simply did not add up. For no mixture of America's congressional or military maneuverings could explain the American victory. By all accounts, the British should have won. Because of this, they decided against the memoir. One renowned historian of the American Revolution, Thomas Fleming, explains the decision. It would be too disillusioning if the American people discovered how often the glorious cause came close to disaster. Fleming concludes his brief narrative explaining that Washington and Thompson jointly agreed that the real secret of America's final victory in the 8-year struggle could be summed up in two words: divine providence." You know, as I was thinking, as I was rereading that excerpt from this book, it occurred to me that if this were a fictional story, if we were reading this as kind of like a, I don't know, a fantasy novel, it probably wouldn't be too popular because we'd simply call it lazy writing. Every time we paint our, you know, our protagonist into a corner that seems inescapable, the best we can come up with is, ooh, another miracle, and they get away safe, right? I mean, that happens over and over again, and we wouldn't accept that in most fictional writing. We want to see escapes and things that are logical, that make sense, and just, you know, coming in and saying, hey, God save the day, we would probably get a little bit bored with. But because this story is true, it's real and it's accurate. It is absolutely awe-inspiring. If Washington couldn't explain how it all worked without divine providence undergirding the whole thing, how could we possibly do American history justice in an educational system that is completely devoid of God? In my opinion, this is why, when God was kicked out of schools in the 1960s, American history followed right on its heels. When you talk about these stories and you share these experiences, a teacher would start to sound almost idiotic if they were to, every time we got to one of these stories, say, and there's this great coincidence, and this never-before-seen storm came in and saved the day. And when you say that 5, 6, 7 times, and there's all of these miraculous instances that if things didn't work out just this way, the odds of this happening are astronomically small, the students would look at him and be like, are you kidding? We're expected to believe that there were this many coincidences to make this happen. You simply cannot do American history justice and come out of it sounding like a sane person without giving credit to its author, to God himself. This is why American history isn't in there anymore. And if it is, it's glossed over, it's very secularized, it's dates, and you don't get all of these incredible stories. But without these incredible stories, there is no revolution. There's a rebellion, and the British win, and we're still under British control. Without these miracles, there's no America. You can't do American history justice without God, because it was his victory, and his fingerprints are all over it. All right, guys. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for this week. We're not done, though, talking about the miracles of the American Revolution. There is one other post-war miracle that deserves a special attention, and we'll cover that one next week. In the meantime, I'd really appreciate it if you would like and subscribe to this podcast. Share it with a friend. These stories are important. We are losing our heritage in this country. We're forgetting how we came to enjoy these great freedoms that we had. So please help me out by sharing and doing whatever you can on whatever platform that you're on to boost this and to get it in front of more people. Thank you so much. God bless, and look forward to seeing you back next week.
Thank you for listening to Abide in Liberty. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes and share this with friends and family. In the meantime, keep up with the show online at abideinliberty.com. Also, if you'd like to help our K-12 bless and educate more families, contact us by visiting libertyyouthacademy.org. Until next time, be on the alert, stand firm in the faith, and be strong.